The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening. And enjoy the show.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable, settle in, turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening, you're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome to Season 6, Episode 19. I'm your host, Otis Gyre. In this episode, I'll be performing three spine-chilling tales for you about nightmarish nature, brutal births, and terrifying towns. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first two terrifying tales. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Our first tale tonight is brand new and debuting here tonight. It comes to us courtesy of author Nick Carlson, and it's likely to leave you, shall we say, buzzing. Without further ado, I present to you Colony Collapse Disorder. The air is filled with smoke, but to Texan farmer Dan Murphy, it was all part of his daily routine. Unlike most men, Don lived for his work days. Even at 57, he never grew tired of the fragment fog of burning wood, the vast blue skies, and the rich, biting taste of the honey his bees tirelessly produced. It certainly wasn't the highest-paying job, but any job that involved going outside and interacting with nature was good enough for him. There were other beekeepers in his town, but Don Murphy was a titan among them. He often joked that half his job consisted of supervising apiaries other than his own. Of all his peers, his colonies were the strongest. They accepted new queens most readily, and their combs practically bled the golden brown stuff. It always humored him how bipolar the attitudes people held toward bees were. Don knew full well that the very same people who bought jars upon jars of honey from him also complained on a weekly basis about the swarms of bees invading their backyards. At least they made up the vast majority of ill will directed toward him. The ones going off about their flowers, their honey, were the most difficult to manage. When all was said and done, they were just folks looking to weasel their way out of another Jew in life. Don valued paying his dues with hard work, the timeless equation of input plus effort equaling output. the greater satisfaction of knowing his toils ultimately made a difference. "I'm one to talk," he thought with a smirk, as he smoked out his first hive. "Is it really work if you enjoy it?" Ignoring the befuddled bees crawling around his mesh visor, he removed the lid from the hive and pulled out a raft, smiling as he saw both sides were almost completely capped over with beeswax. "First go, good job, everyone," he said, depositing the raft into a wheelbarrow. The remainder of the rafts were only half capped, better to let them fill up entirely before harvesting. Don covered the wheelbarrow with a tarp before moving on to the next one. He pumped a fresh round of smoke in and around the openings before taking the lid off and lifting up a raft. Oh, Jesus, no. The raft was also coated with beeswax, but only about 6 adult bees were attached. Instead of crawling among the combs doing their business, they merely hung on, antennae waving feebly as if they'd simply lost the will to continue working. "God damn it, no!" Don muttered, pulling out another raft where he could only see 2. The panic caused his skin to prickle as he moved toward a third raft and witnessed, with a plummeting heart, the nail in the coffin for his hive. The queen, recognizable from her plump size and painted thorax, likewise clung lifelessly onto the raft. Normally the queen was always surrounded by a convoy of worker bees cleaning her, communicating with her, but aside from the defining traits, she might as well have been one more torpid bug in the hive. CCD, Don thought with a sinking chill. Colony collapse disorder, the mysterious condition of bees, abandoning their hives and venturing aimlessly beyond their range, where they all perished in purposeless confusion. The theories regarding CCD were as varied as the answers were few. The only certain thing about it was the frustration and fear that plagued any and all afflicted beekeepers. "Why you all had to go?" Don sighed, before removing all the rafts and stowing them in the wheelbarrow. If the colony had truly gone its way, he might as well reap what he could from them. As he moved to the next hive, a flicker of movement atop a distant hill caught his eye. Squinting through the mesh, he could make out a blurry dot skirting near the crest, obscured by a layer of dry scrub. Coyotes and badgers were the most common interlopers on his property, but this thing's height and gait could only mean one thing. Don dropped the wheelbarrow and drew his revolver from his waistline. "You're on private property," he bellowed out at the figure. "Get the hell out of here. I'm well within my rights to shoot." The thing stopped and shifted, as if turning towards him. Don inched closer, unable still to make out a face. "Turn back now!" The loss of one of his hives had incensed him to the point of spitting with fury, directing his rage toward the trespasser. 3 seconds! The figure seemed to bend over, then straightened up again, rocking back and forth. A gust of dry wind punched in Don's direction, and with it carried the sound of mocking laughter. Don pulled the trigger, and he fell into a split-second shock from the crack of the gun. But he ripped off his mask and stared wildly at where the figure once was. Breathing heavily, he tore through the apiary and up the hill, his bee suit catching on brambles and thorns. A stitch in his side, he arrived at the spot, looking around for any sign of an intruder. Footprints, hair, anything. Nothing. Don emitted a ragged sigh and trudged back. Despite his anger, he knew the trespasser had nothing to do with his hive. Bees would first die attempting to deter an intruder before they went so far as to abandon their home. But as he maneuvered the wheelbarrow among the rest of the hives, he wondered offhandedly how much more strangeness he'd had to put up with. Later that evening, Don and his wife Janine oversaw the extraction of the harvested honey in their garage. A brief spin in a hand-powered centrifuge sucked the liquid from the rasp, which drained through a spigot and through a sieve to catch any errant bits of wax. Despite the drama from earlier in the day, it was a decent haul, nearly 4 jars worth. A2 died today. Don grunted, tying a signature red bow around the jar. Open it up, and damn near nobody was home. Never knew a bee could look depressed, but now I know. Janine lowered her head. She too knew of CCD. Why do they do that, Don? Wish I knew, he replied. If I did, though, they might kill me for owning such knowledge. Janine set her jar aside. I mean, if it ain't parasites or disease or chemicals, could they just up and decide to leave? Decide? The word, in that context, felt like a foreign language on Don's tongue. There's a reason it's called a hive mind. Bees have no free will of their own. They'll stick to their queen until their dying breath. Apparently not. That don't mean they're not physically capable of leaving, Janine countered. If they think something's wrong, they'll jump ship. That's not free will, that's instinct. Come off it, Janine, said Don. They have nowhere to go and they die soon after. What's the point of that instinct? Janine shrugged, looking away. Maybe some things are worse than that. Don scoffed. Well, maybe when you get out there in the sun working with me, you can lecture me on the workings of bees. I'm not getting into this now. Janine snapped, an edge to her tone. She tied off the last jar and strode back into the house. I'm going to bed. Don heard her angry footsteps going up the stairs and settling in their bedroom. He shook his head and grabbed a beer from the fridge, figuring he ought to cool down even more before joining her in bed. He walked out back and settled on his chair, overlooking the desert night. The stars never failed to impress him. A liquid wash of celestial fire in the sky above. The distant buzz of bee activity had finally died down. Bees often worked into the night, but even they had to sleep at some point. The porch light above him dimmed, and he heard the clatter of insect wings. No, please, no, Don moaned, looking up. Bees, affected with a parasitic maggot, would often hurl themselves into lights at night, for similarly unknown reasons. Pathogenic brain worms were the last thing Don wanted to deal with after CCD. But the thing smacking itself against the light was no bee. It was much larger, about the size of his thumb, its wings clacking sickeningly on the glass. It circled erratically like a carp on a line, rendering it difficult to focus on. Don could make out a burnt orange color and black stripes, and dark, waspy eyes. Perhaps a western cicada killer, relatively innocuous despite its name. Regardless, the thing was interfering with his peaceful night, so Don reached over and switched the porch light off. Silence came creeping back, and Don leaned back in his chair, taking a drink, savoring the beer's sweet prickly pear flavor. Listening out, Don heard nothing in the bushes beyond. He smirked. Whoever that was would not come back after being shot at. Sometimes you just gotta let some things speak for themselves, he thought, going for another sip. He shot up from his chair and sputtered frantically as the bottle touched his mouth, and 3 pairs of clawed legs grabbed onto his lower lip. He swatted at his face, dropping the beer, backing up and tripping over his chair. He made contact with something hard and sharp, but not before a shooting pain spiked the corner of his mouth. Shit! He spat, scrambling inside the house, slamming the screen door shut. He hobbled to the bathroom, turning the light on, examining his injured lip in the mirror. Blood oozed from the sting, which seethed on the sensitive skin. He cursed at his stupidity, remembering that pollinating insects were often attracted to fruity aromas. Now he would have to look forward to a swollen face in the morning. Yeah, serves me right. For being an asshole to Janine, he thought bitterly. But as he watched, the wound continued to sear without the debilitating crawl of injected venom. Don stared at his reflection for a solid 10 minutes before going to rub his lip. It hurt, but he concluded it was nothing more than a flesh wound. Strange, he muttered. Looking closer, he saw that instead of swelling, the flesh had been cleaved away, as if from a pair of mandibles. What bit me? He asked himself. Cicada killers certainly didn't bite. Don didn't know of any other insect nests in and around the property. Whatever it was nothing he'd seen before. He washed out the wound with soap and water, squeezing the remaining blood out before dabbing it away and heading up for bed. Everything that day had been so sudden, so fucking weird. Don hoped he would find better respite in his dreams. A buzzing woke him up. Don shot up in his bed, yelping in panic, his lip pulsing with soreness. Then he realized his smartphone was merely vibrating on the nightstand. He picked it up and answered sleepily, "Don Murphy." "Don? It's Carla." His neighbor down the road was a regular who used his honey for baking. I'm going to need another jar soon. Don's brow furrowed. We have plenty in stock right now. You can come on over any time. I did, Carla replied. I tried going up to your door earlier this morning, but your bees kept coming at me. One of them landed in my hair, and I said, nope, and turned right around back home. Nah, that couldn't have been, said Don, rubbing his temples. My bees don't attack people. Well, something did, said Carla, rather sassily. I'm not coming over there again, but if you'd like to bring a jar over to my place, I'd gladly accept that. Okay, sure. Goodbye. Don hung up and immediately went for his bee suit, slipping into it. He had a pretty shrewd suspicion as to what it was that attacked Carla. Janine peered drowsily at him from her spot in the bed. What's the matter, Don? Hopefully nothing, he growled, fastening his mask on. I'm just going to check something. Before his wife could follow up, he was down the stairs and bursting through the front door. The morning sun blinded him, but he couldn't see anything flying around. He examined the potted flowers, the corners of the patio, and the bushes out front. He looked up into the air to empty, cloudless skies. Then, on another gust of dry wind, came the sound of his bees buzzing. They seemed louder than normal and deeper. Shit! Don hissed, rushing around the back of his house to the yard. He rounded the corner and halted when he saw the entire apiary was storming with furious honeybees, battering Don's suit, some trying to sting him. Don brushed them off and charged into the fray. They were all hopped up on defensive pheromones, driven wild with a desire to go after anything that resembled a threat. As to what that threat was, he stopped dead when he saw it. His prize hive, A1, had been bored with jagged holes, and bees were swarming in and out of them, looping erratically around a posse of bulky, demonic hornets that were chewing their way in. Their color and sound matched the mystery bug from the night before. As Don watched in horror, the hornets simply hooked bees with their legs and decapitated them in one fluid motion, discarding their wriggling bodies to the ground below. Don exploded with a scream when he saw what laid on the ground. A virtual carpet of dying honeybees, almost all missing their heads, crawling listlessly over each other, tangling in each other's splattered innards. The hornets were emerging from the hive now, their mandibles stuffed with honey and larvae, which they devoured right before Don's eyes. Don bellowed and ran to the porch, where he grabbed a shovel and sprinted back to the hive, whacking and swinging with all his might. Solid metallic thunks assured him he had hit his mark, but the remaining hornets swirled up in a spiral and descended upon him like predatory birds. Their claws digging in, they bit into his suit and stabbed him with their stingers. Only a few hit skin around his ankles, but Don cried out in agony as the pain exploded in his feet, scorching like bullets of fire. He stamped and jumped, squashing the bugs, which burst their engorged guts over his clothes. He ran back toward the house, throwing open the screen door and slamming it shut. "What happened, Don? Are you okay?" Janine screamed as she bolted down the stairs. Don fell to the floor, clutching his ankles, blowing air through his gritted teeth. "Close the door, the glass door, close it," he rasped. Hornets landed one by one on the mesh panel, burrowing their thick mandibles through, biting lesions through it. "Get out of the way," Janine said, grabbing hold of the door. Don scooted along the floor, groaning as Janine finally slammed the glass door, locking it for good measure. The hornets gathered on the outside, their buzzing vengeful and devilish. "Are the windows closed?" Don demanded. "Yes, they're all closed," Janine confirmed. "Jesus Christ, Don, what the hell are those?" Don tried to bring himself to his hands and knees, but a wave of dizziness struck him, and he fell backward to the floor and vomited. The pain was shooting electricity up his bones, invoking spasms, clouding his head. His last flash of rationale told him he'd only been stung twice or thrice, not nearly enough to cause serious damage. As tears squeezed through his eyes, he shot one last glance through the glass at his ravaged apiary and saw a man standing among the swarm. He was barefoot and fully covered with animal pelts, his eyes wide and white, and his mouth was unhinged in laughter. And the sound of it seeped through the glass, and Don convulsed again as he suddenly recognized that laugh. The jeering noise followed him into unconsciousness, and he slipped away into a void of hellish black. On the couch, Don came around, feeling as though baseballs had been stuffed under the skin of his ankles. He leaned up and saw both feet sported two swollen red lumps. Janine had pulled up an ottoman futon and was applying a hydrocortisone cream to his wounds. "Take this," she said tenderly, handing him a pill and a glass of water. Don swallowed the pill without taking a drink. "The hives," he croaked, looking at his wife. She shook her head. They're gone. But they were at it for hours." Don's head fell back onto the cushion as he stared unseeingly into space. 10 years of management and upkeep, of connections and dealings, gone in the span of hours. "Those things were some kind of hornet," he said. "I've never seen anything like them before." "I have," said Janine. Don looked at her and she blinked. "No, I'm sorry. I found them online. Look." She unlocked her smartphone and showed the screen to Don, who craned his neck for a better angle. A blown-up picture of one of the hornets dominated the screen, its eyes black and sinister, jaws splayed in a threatening pose. "Vespa mandarina," read Don. "Asian giant hornet. Yes, I've heard of those too. But what are they doing in Texas? And so many of them, at least a hive's worth." "I was doing more research," Janine said. "You were out a long time. They began turning up on the West Coast a few years back. Everyone thought they were isolated occurrences, but now I'm paying for it," said Don. "Those things showed up and destroyed my work. We're ruined." "Don, I'm sorry, but surely we can start over, can't we?" "No." Don swung his feet onto the floor and yelped as he put pressure on them. "If these things propagate and spread, there won't be anything to start over with. They were systematic. How they butchered my bees, like, that's what they're evolved to do. These things are a goddamn death warrant for people like us." "So what are we going to do then?" Janine demanded. "We'll have to get rid of them." Don stood shakily to his feet, wincing from the burning agony. Spread the word. Start calling people. Friends, family, neighbors. He began pacing in place, working the pains out of his feet. If they're really gone, we need pictures of the hives. That'll get people talking, that's for damn sure. Don, there's one more thing. Janine said softly. Don looked at her. What? Janine pointed behind him to the glass back door. Overcome with dread, Don turned around and looked. Smeared on the outside of the glass were letters, sickly yellow, studded with black specks. Don inched forward down the hallway, staring at disbelief at the words on the door. Find me. Don mouthed the words to himself, the image of that skin-clad man in the swarm suddenly striking through his mind. He turned and looked at his wife, who stared back at him, her expression one of unsettled confusion. Someone's doing this to us, he declared. Someone set those things on us. But why? Would you know this person? Janine inquired. No, I can't imagine anyone who'd do this to us, said Don, resuming his manic pacing. We need to call the police, then, said Janine, pulling out her phone. No, Don commanded. That won't do. We can't pin him to the Hornets. All I can say is that he was trespassing. And the police won't do shit about the Hornets, even if they could find out where they've gone. Don hobbled to the glass door, pulling his boots from the closet. I've worked too long and too hard to let this all go to waste. He fondled the top shelf, feeling around until he found his revolver. There's no one to blame for this, but that don't mean I can't do nothing about it. I'm going with you, said Janine, walking toward him. No, you're not, Don snapped. What if it's a trap? You stay here and watch the house, and if I'm not back in an hour, then you call the police. Don, Janine said simply. You and me are in this together. I'm coming with. That man's a fucking psychopath, Don shouted, advancing towards her. I'm not going to have you gutted or raped or whatever the fuck's on his mind. He tightened his grip on the revolver. I forbid you. Janine's face tightened. I don't need you to be a hero, Donald. I need you to be a husband. I am. He opened the glass door and slammed it in her face. I'm taking back our lives, because that's what I have to do. He holstered the gun and turned his back on her. Don had to fight back tears as he passed through the remains of his apiary. Half of his hives had been brutalized, each with their own mass killing of bees long dead. The other hives appeared to have been untouched. But Don walked up to one and flung the lid off, lifting a raft, just as he thought only a few benumbed workers and a single queen remained. They left, he said, rather die starving and alone than face what was coming. He hesitated. How long have they been gone? During or after the assault? Or, he shuddered with forbearing, before. A rattling emanated from one of the damaged hives. The lid jerked as if something was pushing from underneath, and a single hornet crawled onto the top, coated in honey and the soiled corpses of baby bees, absent-mindedly chewing on one as it stared blankly at Don. Don stared back, drew his gun and fired. The lid blasted off, and what little remained of the hornet's mangled body fell softly to the ground. That's the least you deserve, he thought bitterly, pounding up the hill. The late afternoon sun beat down on him as he walked, scanning the vast, shrub-ridden desert, dyeing the rocks red and setting a haze in the distance. Don ruefully regretted not bringing a canister of water. He'd been more preoccupied with raining hell upon the marauder than considering his own health. His sweaty jeans chafed at his skin. His brain felt full of dusty air. But he kept his gaze on the horizon, determined to seek out the bastard, where he was hiding, and how he was controlling so many hyper-aggressive insects. Something buzzed past the back of his neck and he jolted, swatting reflexively. A hornet had zoomed past him and settled deep within a grove of desert scrub. The longer Don watched, the clearer he could hear a monotonous hum, as if hundreds of bugs were moving in unison. "Let's see what the fuck kind of hive you're keeping," Don said, turning and heading for the grove. The branches were thick and bunched up against each other. He had to grab and break them away until he could squeeze through a gap. He emerged into a stony clearing and startled, drawing his gun. "I wouldn't take that shot, or else it would be your last," the apparition sneered. Don stowed the gun and glared at the man before him. Up close, underneath the shroud of pelts, Don could see he was very old, with sun-baked skin and deep wrinkles. A rabbit-skin hood obscured most of his face, but Don could make out yellow teeth and those same crazy eyes. "Who the hell are you, and why are you so keen on destroying us?" The old man snickered, rocking back and forth in spastic laughter. "I have nothing against you, sir." "You?" Don leveled the gun again. "You set those murder hornets on our property and killed every last one of our bees. I am far within my rights to kill you dead." "Still your wrath," the old man said. "No matter what comes out of this little powwow, I'm afraid you'll face the losing end. I suggest you see it through." Don kept his gun aimed at him, but his arm began to shake as fresh sweat beaded on his forehead. "Who are you?" "That's immaterial," the old man laughed. "But what I am Yi Nodlushi, only an agent of the inevitable, caught on nature's sweeping tide." "What the hell does that mean?" Don shouted. "Colonial arrogance at its most naked," said the old man, "so concerned with molding this good earth like children playing with clay, woefully ignorant to the whim of the Great Mother." Don fingered the trigger. "Start talking sense." The old man leered, eyeing him for an ugly moment. "You and I are a lot alike in some ways," he finally said. "I, too, loathe the arrival of these winged devils." He overturned his hand and a hornet crawled from inside his sleeve, settling in his palm. "When they came, when they enacted their scourge, I asked myself, how could this have happened? What did we do to deserve such unholy misery?" His head twitched and his neck gave a gnarly crunch. But I reminded myself each action must have a consequence. And this is no more apparent than in the colonial arrogance I endure each and every day. He bared his decrepit teeth at Don. "When you spread your roots and shook hands with the rest of the world, did you really not expect to transmit a few germs?" As Don listened with disgust, he realized that the buzzing, at first silenced, had begun to well up again. But the old man continued to talk. "When you dig a canal, the water flows and things change forever. That is not a result of your ingenuity. That is just nature taking its course. What is happening here is nature taking its course. No matter how wicked and backwards that may be." He grinned again. "That is where you and I are very different. You are a suppressor. I am its emissary." You did this because we think we're above nature?" Don figured. The buzzing had grown louder. He had to shout to make himself heard. "But I'm a beekeeper. Bees are endangered as they are. I keep them. They pollinate and thrive. How am I the bad guy? Why do I deserve this? Swallow your vanity, the old man snarled. You did nothing to deserve this. All I've done is ensure the consequences. Your bees were smart enough to leave their hives because they too went with nature's course, and you, standing in its way, propped up tall with your pride, will suffer the humiliating indignity of... Don shot the old man. He shuddered from the impact, his face frozen in mid-speech. Some yellow, glutinous juice frothed at his lips. His body gave an almighty tremor, and his pelts fell to the ground. Don let out a piercing shriek. The old man's bare skin from the neck down was peppered with a geometric pattern of holes, the texture of honeycomb, and crawling in and out of the flesh were thousands of hornets, the source of intensifying buzz. His eyes degraded into jelly, and two hornets burst forth from them, scuttling over his bald scalp, but the thing still cracked a smile. I warned you, it would be your last. Don scooted backwards, distancing himself from the creature, but it shambled towards him, trembling at its knees. I am Chaos, skinwalker to the winged devils. His voice was amplified and garbled, as if filtered through the hornets themselves. And while whittling through his powwow, I've unleashed chaos elsewhere, for such is its nature to strike with tenacious dispassion. No! Don bellowed, realizing instantly what he'd meant. He turned and crashed through the bushes, his feet blazing with fresh pain, limping as fast as he could back over the hill, where his house was, where his wife was. The buzzing hit an ungodly pitch behind him, and he upped his pace, threatening to trip and fall forward with each step. The settling sun was plunging the rocks into formless shadow. His foot struck a cactus, and he screamed, pushing forward against the spine in his toe. The hill was just ahead. He clambered up it and threw his gaze down the slope to his house. And beyond his ruined hives, motionless at the center of the house, a figure writhed on the ground, surrounded by a gyrating swarm of hornets. No! Janine! Don screamed. He tumbled down the hill in his haste, colliding with rocks and shrubs, sliding to stop among a field of gravel. Broken, scraped, and in excruciating pain, Don crawled on the ground, blubbering madly, tears mixing with the blood in his mouth. Janine, please, no! He arrived at her side, riddled with pain, enduring fresh stings, staring down in tear-stricken horror. His wife's clothes were soaked through with red pinpricks, and every inch of her exposed skin was covered with swollen, necrotic sores. His hand reached for her head, but he stopped himself. He wanted to remember his wife's face as it was, beautiful, clean, and unmarred. As the venom pumped through his blood, he summoned the last jolt of energy and staggered to his feet, stumbling for the porch door. He grabbed the handle, leaning forward on it, and collapsed inside, finally kicking it shut. Immediately, a hail of hornets drilled into the glass, their durable exoskeletons resounding in sickening thunks. They chewed at the glass so close Don could see their individual mouthparts, flexing and glittering. Then they scurried beyond the door, onto the outside walls. They'll get in. If they want to, they will. He hauled himself across the floor, his body racked with toxins, the furniture swimming freely in his vision. He ended up in the living room, next to the couch Janine had treated him on, the water and medicine still sat on the table. Crawling towards it, he splashed the water on his face and downed a handful of antihistamines. It did nothing to quell the venom, but he could think Claire now. She was right, he whispered, his eyes reddened from crying. They knew. They fled, or at least some of them did. The hornet's buzz echoed down from up the chimney. Don turned his head to stare at it. Slumped against the futon, the bones in his limbs tingled uncomfortably, then fell limp beside him. A scatterplot of stings around his body flared with an acid kick, signifying his flesh had begun to dissolve. Something inhuman was creeping down the chimney, dripping its honeydewed blood. A few scouts had already emerged, hovering slowly above Don's shattered body, as if smelling his imminent death. Illuminated in a shaft of moonlight, the skinwalker reached its gangly arms from the chimney, dragging its way up the wall, gripping it with slender talons. A convoy of hornets clung to it like spiderlings. It twisted its neck to peer down at Don. "Pity," it drooled. "You too tried to flee, defiant of nature to your dying breath." It emitted an insectoid chatter. "Ignominy will be your coffin." Paralyzed from the neck down, Don tore his eyes away from the skinwalker, laying them instead on the medicine and water, the last things he saw Janine hold in her hands. His lips tightened with grief. He could still smell her perfume in the air, underneath the putrid scent of carrion and peat. Something laid on the floor next to the photon. Don squinted to focus on it. It was her smartphone. Don recalled the moment he'd come to. She was there, showing him that phone, relaying knowledge to him in her angelic voice. She knew about the hornets. She knew about CCD. She knew. Don turned again to face the creature. He could feel the stiffness rising up his throat. Nevertheless, he spoke up. "End me, then," he gurgled. "But one day, you'll have to face the inevitable." "I am the inevitable," the skinwalker rasped. "You may have beaten me, but there are others out there, too. And like it or not, people are a part of nature, too." Don drew one final breath into his blackening lungs. "And when the chips are down, you'll find that those others will come roaring back, once they know how to beat you. You think you're some freaking higher being, but you're part of this just like everything else, everyone else. And once we know how to deal with you, nature will, in due time, take its course." The skinwalker bared its teeth, its limbs trembling, with the effort to hold itself up. Don stared it down, forcing himself to remain lucid until the end. "Kill," it hissed. As the hornets descended upon him, Donald Murphy felt the stirrings of something inscrutable and intangible, but somehow necessary, and all too real in spite of everything that had happened. Assurance.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
I hope you enjoyed Colony Collapse Disorder, as written by Nick Carlson and performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed what you heard, I'd like to encourage you to visit the author's official website at nickcarlsonpress.com, where you'll find links to his book for sale and his social media and ways to get in touch. Or check him out on Amazon.com, where you'll find his debut novel, Simeon. In this novel, we'll meet Diana, a defector to the Soviet Union, who blows up her own American platoon in an act of terroristic defiance. Afterwards, she finds herself shuttled to a secret military laboratory deep in the Siberian tundra, and at the mercy of its shady director's bizarre and restrictive policies. Their experiment is a hybrid of man and ape, reared to be the ultimate soldier. But as a mysterious delusion passes among the workforce, and as friends and enemies succumb to the madness, Diana discovers an existential corruption, not just in what she believes, but in the human condition itself. If that sounds like something you'd love to dig your claws into, again, you can find Simeon on Amazon.com or through Nick's website. Once more, that's nickcarlsonpress.com. Thanks for your support of this very talented author and of indie horror. And don't forget to let Nick know that Otis sent you. It means a lot to me. Up next, we've got another second tale of terror for you, courtesy of author S.R. Underschultz, which brings a whole new meaning to the phrase birthing pains. And I'm going to warn you right now, this tale's a doozy. Not for the faint of heart. You've been warned. Without further ado, I present to you Mouthborn. Sickness overcame Emily without warning. While we strode arm's length through downtown after a late movie, taking turns trashing it, Emily became silent and stopped walking. I thought maybe she'd stepped in gum or forgot something at the theater, but on her face grew an expression signaling something far more severe. Face pale, her pupils unfocused, roved side to side, her mouth agape. The action of my heart increased, and against the back of my mouth I tasted the smell of wet pavement. People walked by, their footfalls so loud, each step stung my ears. My arm moved around Emily's shoulders. "You all right?" Her eyes flared wide open and darted up to meet mine. "Jacob!" Her voice came out, strained, panicked. "Emily, what's wrong?" I fought to keep cool, to pretend my palms weren't sweaty. I'd never seen her like this. Every muscle in her face tensed. Her body rippled with tremors. Frantic, I scanned the street for what, I don't know. For help, for a hospital, a cop, anything. Her head jerked into my chest, and she clutched my sweater. "Something's in me." "It's okay, sweetie, it's okay. I'll call an ambulance." A violent paroxysm jolted her. It stole my breath, blanked my thoughts. Hands wrapped around her belly, she slowly, painfully doubled over. "Jacob, help," she said, barely audible. Before I could reply, she looked at me again, and I saw it. Being a foot taller, I had a clear view into her mouth as she opened it. I can scarcely believe it was real. So shocked, I froze, my eyes unblinking, mind locked. A hand clawed and scratched its way out of Emily's mouth from inside her body. A human hand, quickly joined by another. Emily could do nothing. Her eyes wide as eggs, unable to utter a sound. Her body convulsed, and her throat bulged as the strange hands gripped both rows of teeth and pushed her mouth wide open, wider and wider, until, with a bone-splitting crack, her jaw unhinged. Emily collapsed into me, the oddly heavy weight of her body I couldn't brace, so I broke her fall onto the sidewalk and helped lay her on her back. Gaining enough of my senses to make noise, I screamed for help, to someone, to call an ambulance. and looking up, realized a small crowd had formed around us, their phones held up, filming. Several heavy cracks, like breaking ribs, drew my attention back to Emily. The blood drained from my head, my stomach knotted, and I nearly fainted, so traumatized by what I saw. Arms, slick with blood and viscera, reached through Emily's mouth, bent at the elbows, and with its hands found purchase on Emily's shoulders. Like a snake shedding its skin, the creature, which seemed an adult human, kicked and yanked the bloated, disfigured body of my girlfriend off itself. The screams and cries from the crowd were lost on me. The connection between my mind and body short-circuited, my consciousness able only to witness the horror unfold. From the enormous hole that moments ago was Emily's mouth, a head emerged, glistening with blood and mucus. Half out, the naked, blood-covered creature sat upright and pulled Emily's lifeless body, now reduced to a hollow sack of skin and bones, off its legs like a pair of pants. The creature wiped a thick red webbing of mucus from its eyes and opened them. It glanced up, and our eyes met. "No, it can't be," I thought. "It was Emily." After the incident, the creature that came out of Emily's body, the thing that outwardly seemed identical to her in every way, was taken to the hospital and quarantined. Countless tests were done on it. Meanwhile, I tried my best to answer questions the police and the FBI asked me. There was plenty of footage of them to look at. So many witnesses had filmed the gruesome scene, and each had gone viral by the time I got home. Of my Emily, the woman I'd known and loved, there was nothing left except the bloody pile left on the sidewalk by the strange imposter. In shock, I barely spoke and didn't eat for several days, my mind reeling with the unsolvable thoughts, and, like the rest of the world, unable to process what had happened. The media attention was astronomical. I avoided everyone and refused to leave the bedroom of my apartment. Without showering or changing clothes, I developed a putrid stink as I waited for news from the doctors about what had happened. Finally, when the doctors did have news, it provided no comfort. According to them, the creature lying in the bed of its quarantined hospital room was Emily, right down to her DNA. She had Emily's memories, and apparently, under rigorous interrogation by doctors and FBI investigators, she could recall the details of her life with great accuracy. In fact, the only memory she didn't have was of the horrific event itself. This imposter recalled everything up until feeling sick outside the movie theater, when, according to her, everything went blank. "What about Emily's body?" I asked the doctor over the phone. "The real Emily's body, the one on the sidewalk." "DNA tests prove that's Emily, too," the doctor said. "This time, we can't explain her transformation. Not without more tests. I know that isn't what you want to hear, but obviously, this epidemic is unprecedented." My brow furrowed. "Epidemic? What do you mean? You haven't seen the news?" "I guess not. Transformations like Emily's have been popping up all over the world. But it appears as though Emily was the first." My jaw clenched. I couldn't speak. I'd been so wrapped up in my own pain and shock and grief, I hadn't had the strength to see another screen with a story about Emily, so I turned off my phone and went completely offline. "But," the doctor continued, "you'll be happy to know Emily is completely healthy and cleared to leave quarantine. Would you like to see her? She hasn't stopped talking about you." "See her?" I muttered. What was she? How could I face that thing again after it literally ripped my girlfriend apart, then somehow stole her identity? Legs weak, palms soaked, could barely grip the phone. The sour stink from my armpits nearly made me gag. It was a wreck. Now this thing wants to see me? If there are more of these things, couldn't they be aliens? Or some disease that could be contagious? I said. There's no evidence it's contagious or aliens, assured the doctor. Every case so far has been isolated incidents, with no contact having occurred between victims. Emily is being quarantined for 3 weeks and shows no sign of ill health or further mutation. I rubbed my head. 3 weeks? Now, it's only been a few days, hasn't it? You were in shock, the doctor said. After such a traumatic event, it's not surprising you lost track of time. Wait. So what do you want me to do? Jacob, the hospital's full. We're desperate. We need beds for regular patients. I have no reason not to discharge her. He paused to issue a long sigh. We realize this is a difficult time for you. I cleared my throat. A difficult time. But Emily's ready to go home. Outside her room at hospital, I stood immobilized, wondering whether I could go through with it. Could I really let this thing into my apartment and live with it? I'd finally caught up in the news, and the doctor was right. What happened to Emily had happened to hundreds around the world, more every day. So many births had been filmed and had gone viral. Mouthborn, people called them. They seemed normal, did interviews with the news and everything, all stating the exact same thing as Emily, that they remembered everything about their lives except being mouthborn. Even couples like Emily and I had been interviewed, seemingly accepting the new mouthborn member of the family, no doubt making a fortune along the way. I'd been offered $1 million by a journalist on my way into the hospital for an exclusive interview with me and Emily, the first mouthborn. Am I making too much of this? I thought. Shouldn't I be happy Emily's alive in any form? The other mouthborn seemed like regular people. She probably is, too. If I can't distinguish between the new Emily and the old Emily, what's the difference? Slowly, I pushed open the door and entered. In a hospital gown, on the bed, there it was. It looked exactly like Emily, just as I remembered her. Its face lit up at the sight of me. Jacob, oh, thank goodness you came. I missed you so much. She welled up with tears and held out a hand toward me. A few steps from the end of the bed, I remained standing, unable to speak. It looked and sounded like the Emily I'd known for so many years. I wanted to rush up and hug her, but something held me back. The memory. That night, outside the theater, seeing the terror in Emily's eyes. That was my Emily. Not this thing, with no memory of the night at all. The worst night of our lives. Sweetie, it's me. I swear it's me, Emily said. Her wet-green eyes pleaded. She shuffled forward. I know you're freaked out. What happened is super weird, I know, but you have to believe me, Jacob. She was crying. I need you so badly. I'm scared. She reached out again and swallowed hard. Emily hugged her knees. Her cries broke into sobbing. No longer could I fight the urge to console her. Maybe this was Emily. Or at least enough of her was, enough for me. Tears streamed down my face as I moved next to the bed and sat down. Resting her head gently on my shoulder, she uttered tender cries of relief. I missed you so much, she said between sobs. I missed you too. 2 months have passed since Emily was mouthborn. We'd signed an exclusive with a news company and did an interview for $1 million. We even signed a book deal. It seemed too good to be true, but it was happening. We were rich, and we had each other. Our shitty jobs behind us, we were able to move into a fancy apartment and fill it with the highest quality furnishings. But sitting with Emily at the breakfast table, aimlessly scrolling through the news, I couldn't help puzzling over little details, little inconsistencies that nagged my brain like a splinter. For example, when I'd asked Emily if she wanted to go to a movie on the weekend, she didn't want to and preferred staying home to watch trashy reality TV, which she'd become glued to day and night. Before, Emily hated reality TV and loved our movie nights. But she'd been through a traumatic change, whether she remembered it or not. Who was I to judge how she processed it? Another thing worried me, though. Emily had taken to drinking. Every day since she got out of the hospital, she started at about sunset and kept going late into the evening. A bottle of wine disappeared in no time at all, and then she'd yell and curse at his shows and laugh so loud I couldn't get to sleep. Emily never used to drink that much, only on social occasions. This morning, when I looked across at her, she gave me a sad smile. Her lips curled at the edges in a way I'd never seen before. And I got a sinking feeling that there would be never an explanation for what she was, or for any of the thousands of Mothborn out there. "How you feeling?" I asked. She shrugged. "Fine." "Not hungover?" She shook her head. "Don't get hangovers." "You used to." "I know." "You drank a lot last night," I said. She issued me a cold stare, got up from the table, and went to the couch without saying another word. "I'm worried about you," I said. "Can we talk?" She spooned some cereal into her mouth. "What about?" "Everything's happened so fast. We haven't discussed your transformation. I watched you get ripped open from the inside. I mean, the other you." Emily didn't reply. Instead, she turned on the TV and kept eating. It didn't add up. Emily and I used to talk about everything. Two open books. No, this Mothborn thing in my house wasn't Emily. It was an imposter. "What are you?" I said. Again, no response, expressionless. She remained glued to the screen. "Will you answer me?" She rose from the couch, lifted the cereal bowl above her head, and smashed it on the floor. "I'm sick of this!" Nostrils flared. She glared daggers at me from across the room. "Everything I do now, you're like, you didn't used to do that, or you used to do this. You're suspicious of every move I make." She gave a long, exasperated sigh and pulled her hair. Her hands trembled. "There's nothing, is there?" she said. "Nothing I'll ever do to convince you it's me." My stomach knotted. Scrubbing a hand over my face, I cursed myself for being so stupid, so mean. What did I expect, that she'd be just like before? "You're not the same either, you know," Emily said. "You haven't been sleeping or eating properly, and you've barely touched me." She sucked a breath, holding back crying. Dullness filled my chest. What kind of life would I have if I didn't accept Emily? What was the point of staying together if I didn't trust her? "You're right, we're both screwed up," I said. "But I'm the only one being an asshole." I smiled at her lamely. "I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said those things." She nodded. Across the carpet, we patted to each other and embraced. That night, we became intimate for the first time since it happened. Afterward, encouraged by a powerful appetite, I padded to the kitchen and made myself a sandwich. Munching and sipping from a can of beer, I felt giddy with happiness. "Everything's going to be okay," I thought. "Who cares if Emily's Mothborn? She's my partner, and I'll always love her, no matter what. Like everything else we've faced, we'll get through this together." Polishing off the beer, eyelids heavy, I looked forward to finally getting a good night's sleep. I threw the empty can into the recycler, cleaned my plate, shut off the light, and went into the hall. Walking down the hallway, my gut ignited with sharp pain. Moaning, I barely took another step before doubled over by a wave of searing muscle spasms in my abdomen. Adrenaline shot through me. No, this can't be, it can't be happening. Inside my gut formed a solid mass that quickly animated, and like a caged animal, it churned my insides, as if searching for an escape route, all the while growing larger and larger, bloating my stomach. My vision blurred, the hallway tilted beneath my feet, and I braced against the wall. Heart pounding, my mind overwhelmed with terror, I rushed as fast as I could into the bathroom and flicked on the light. I needed to confirm that this wasn't what I dreaded. No, I'm just sick. Something I ate. Hands clenched at the edge of the sink. I leaned towards the mirror and opened my mouth. An involuntary whimper escaped my lips. I ceased breathing. From the darkness of my throat crawled out 5 human fingers. I tried to scream but found no air to do it. The creature's hand gripped my tongue. I shut my mouth tight as possible. The thing inside yanked my tongue, trying to pull itself out of me, the pain unbelievable. I nearly collapsed, but fought through it. I didn't want to die, and I refused to let this thing win. No time to think of what else to do, I ran into the kitchen, took a long paring knife for my knife block, and went back to the mirror. The hand fingered my teeth, trying to gain purchase, but I ground them together. No air could pass the arm in my throat. I was suffocating. The paring knife jutted an inch from my mouth. I stared at my reflection. A panicked man, sweaty and wide-eyed, mouth bulged. This is it. Do it now. Unclenching my jaw, I let my mouth snap open. The hand lunged into my paring knife and retreated into pain. I stabbed at it, jabbing over and over, so frantic. I sliced my cheeks and tongue. Strings of bloody saliva dripped from lips. The hand retreated down my throat as I stabbed deeper. It retracted far enough for me to squeeze some air into my lungs. Globs of blood-soaked flesh spilled into the sink as I lowered my head, exhausted. My whole mouth stung. Tears streamed from my eyes. "Sweetie," a familiar voice said. I turned, and there was Emily standing in the bathroom doorframe. "It's okay," she said. "Let him out." I hope you enjoyed Mouthborn by author S.R. Underschultz and performed by yours truly. I'd like to thank you personally for joining me for this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes, featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groschik. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?